Hello. On this podcast, we talk about movies, their faults, their flaws, and their plots. So, expect some spoilers.
You've been warned.
Welcome to Plot Spackle. I'm John, and my favorite spice is classic black pepper.
I'm Eric, and I'm pretty basic, so I'm going to go with the pumpkin spice for my favorite spice.
I'm Richard, and my favorite spice is ginger spice. Definitely going with Jerry Halliwell here.
Wait, you chose the Spice Girls?
Well, yeah. Look, 85 million records sold can't be wrong.
Yet no one admits to owning those records.
Look, where are the records?
But at the same time, everybody listens to It's Raining Men. Jerry Halliwell, just saying.
All right, yeah, let's, he's won us over. There you go, ginger spice. And we're talking about spices, and where you have these plot holes to fill. Massive plot holes just sitting in a desert.
We can fill them with sand.
What about excessive exposition? It was at that moment I realized that excessive exposition would require excessively excess exposition. Probably a space princess giving me narration and fading in and out as she remembers. There's even more narration.
John, why are you whispering? We're right here.
I was just thinking quietly into the microphone. Much like the movie we're talking about did. It's called Dune. D-U-N-E. Dune. Dune, it's a movie.
Oh, I thought it was called Arrakis.
That's another name for the planet, but the movie's called Dune, and Dune is a nickname for Arrakis because it is the only planet in this version of space that has dunes on it.
I don't think that's true.
Why wouldn't they call it something else then?
They called it Arrakis.
Yeah, but they also nicknamed it Dune.
Because it has a lot of them.
But then if there was another planet with a lot of dunes, that'd be confusing. They'd have to come up with a different nickname for that one.
They called that one Tatooine, John.
That one nickname, like, that's not a nickname, though. That's an official name.
I'm
saying they could have called Arrakis Giant Wormland, all right? Or Wormville.
Apparently, Giant Wormland didn't go well with the marketing team.
Spicy. They could have called it Spicy. Oh, you know, because maybe it's a secret that that's where the spice comes from.
Yeah, you don't want to share where you can get your melange.
So it's just Wormland. It's Wormland.
Tremors.
But this is a movie.
No, Tremors was a better movie.
And did it have a plot? Eric, are you ready for this plot? Can you explain this plot?
Can you do it as succinctly as Roger Ebert did?
Well, I haven't read his review, but... let me go through mine first, and then we'll do the Roger Ebert.
All right.
All right. So the plot synopsis for Dune is, a beginning is the time for taking the most delicate care that the balances are correct. This every sister of the Bene Gesserit knows. To begin your study in the life of Muad'Dib, then take care that you first place him in his time. Born in the 57th year of the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV.
Are you just reading Dune?
Well, I'm not just reading. I mean, I'm narrating. But
that's like the exact opposite because, I mean, if you think about it, the Dune movie is just succinctly explaining the plot of the book.
So you just want me to condense it down?
Yeah. What's this? How did Ebert do it?
Here we go. It has to do with a young hero's personal quest. He leads his people against an evil baron and tries to destroy galaxy-wide trade in spice, drug produced on the desert planet. Spice allows you to live indefinitely while you discover you have less and less to think about.
And there we go. That is what the movie is kind of about.
Ebert had sick burns about this movie.
Okay, well... He did it more succinctly than I would have.
And now he's gonna follow up with movie facts. Do you have a movie fact?
This movie was too long?
All right, that is a fact.
There we go. This movie was released on the 14th of December, 1984. Had a budget of about $40 million. Earned $6 million in its opening weekend, and now with its cult classic status, has managed to earn $30 million of the dollars in its cumulative worldwide release.
What gets me about this is this was a winter release.
Yep.
So what it says about this movie is that people were not willing to pay money to sit in a warm theater if this was playing.
No.
Most winter movies don't do very well, though.
That's true. Well, at this time period, at least. Yeah. More modern movies are more likely to do better in winter.
Maybe we just have better...
But yeah, what about some other facts about this movie?
Well, for your theaters, some of the movies included cheat sheets for some of the vocabulary and plot elements for the film's release, because it was kind of dense. And Sir Patrick Stewart said that the still suit from the movie was the single most uncomfortable costume he had ever worn. While Max von Sydow said the same, but he said that he liked the way he looked in it. And then the giant desert down in Mexico, they had people spent 2 months cleaning out 3 square miles of desert to film this movie in.
You know, there's a big desert across the ocean called the Sahara. I'm pretty sure that's emptier than Mexico.
Yeah, but Tunisia is now Tatooine, and so you can't go there anymore.
Mm.
It would be ripping off Star Wars, like the rest of this movie.
I thought the book was older than Star Wars, though.
It is. But that's one of the reasons this movie didn't do well, is because everybody assumed it was Star Wars.
Or like a ripoff of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because there were actually a lot of those. But I'm still stuck on this cheat sheet. Like most movie tie-ins, you know, you get your special popcorn tin.
Yeah, your cup with a...
This one comes with a glossary of terms.
Yeah. Otherwise, John, how are you supposed to know what a Kiswash Haderach is?
You know, to be honest, I think that was the right thing. I think that was the right call, because I think I needed a little piece of paper with all these terms on it, so as they came up in the movie, I could keep track, because I don't remember half of them now.
I watched this movie today, and I don't even remember, like, 90% of them.
Well, there
you go. I know the main character's name is Paul. But that changes halfway through the movie, so...
No, his name stays Paul. It's his last name that changes.
But for a while, he goes by Usul. And then he became Muad'Dib. And then he was the Kiswash Haderach.
So this movie has plot holes, right?
Well...
Are there more facts?
There are more facts.
There's facts. Is there as many facts as there are minutes in this movie? Because that's too many facts.
No. There are actually less facts than there are minutes in the film. There are some other entertaining ones. We'll get to them later, though. Don't worry.
Yeah, let's talk about these plot holes, and then we can have beef about this movie.
So, we've got the weirding modules that House Atreides has.
Oh.
The weirding way.
Where are we getting our plot holes from?
We are getting these from an article on Tor, where called David Lynch's Dune is what you get when you build a science fiction world with no interest in science fiction.
Okay.
Wait, this is an article review about the movie that has the plot holes listed?
Yes, it says that they have plot holes, and then it lists some of those plot holes.
Well, that's nice of them.
That is.
No, it's very strange. I was pleased, though.
Do they have bullet holes?
Or
bullet points?
They do not have bullet points, but they do go... They do start their paragraph with the sentence that talks about plot holes, and then the rest of the paragraph is about those plot holes.
All right. Well, yeah, let's hear these plot holes, then.
So, we have the weirding modules owned by House Atreides that get destroyed in the attack leading up to Duke Leto's death. Sorry, guys, you're going to need a glossary of terms. We'll put those probably in the doobly-doo or something. Anyhow, so Paul, he's given the schematics for weirding modules by UA, right? Yeah. All right. He gets given the schematics for them, but then he somehow manages to manufacture one to use to train the Fremen, and then makes hundreds more to arm them with, and then creates Gatling versions of them. And where did he get all of this?
Didn't Yue give them the instructions on how to build them?
He gave them the instructions on how to build one of them.
Didn't they have a whole, like, group of them at the fortress, though?
Those were all blown up.
Well, yes, but that means they've been able to mass manufacture them.
But the Fremen don't have access to those.
But they have at least the weirding unit that Paul had when he escaped from the fortress.
But he didn't have one when he escaped from the fortress. Because he didn't escape from the fortress, he was tied up and chucked in the back.
But I think he had one with him on the ship. And they took it apart, and he's like, oh, this is how it works. Because all it is, really, is a bunch of plastic made to look like a weird sci-fi weapon, and then a resonance crystal. It's always crystals.
I see.
Because it is audio-based. It's sound controlled by saying Chalk Saw, or Paula Deeb, or what was the other one?
Fusro Da.
That's it.
They didn't try that. I think that's the most powerful version.
That's like the level 3 version. Like, you got Foos, obviously.
Yeah, there's Foos and then Ro. And that's like Chalk Saw,
mm-hmm.
which is destroy rock.
And then Muad'Dib, which is kill people.
Yeah. So, they it's a basic concept. It's like the, you know, in Dumbo.
But if they're this easy to manufacture, how come everybody doesn't have these weirding modules?
Because the weirding is one of those witch things, and the witches keep secrets.
But it's not one of the witch things. It's a House Atreides thing.
It's not a common technique that the entire house uses. It's only the son and the mom who knows actually how to use the weirding voice.
No, the voice is a different thing.
I think they're connected.
I thought they were...
What I understood it was that it was a weirding, like a connected thing. And the reason the Fremen can do it is also because they're a bit more weird than everyone else.
Well, yeah, their eyes glow blue all the time.
Yeah, their eyes glow blue all the time. And so that's something that they can learn. And like I said, it's just a resonance crystal. Probably get it from a Cracker Jack box if you really want it.
I'm going to say, John, though, you're kind of wrong about the resonance crystal. That's not the best way to have it. Everyone knows that vinyl is a superior format. And,
well, unfortunately, he couldn't have kept the vinyl in that desert heat.
That's why he had to make so many.
Yeah, so I feel like at least one version of the weapon was he took with him. Or also, I bet his mother, who was also an escapee.
Again, not an escapee, just tied up.
They escaped. They totally escaped just but because...
They didn't escape from the palace. They escaped from a shuttle.
It doesn't matter. They escaped from the raid, and I bet she was involved in making the weirding modules for the soldiers. So she probably was familiar with the design enough to instruct them.
Okay.
And then they had their own witching society as part of the Fremen, and that helped with the different permutations of the devices to get the Gatling Chalk Saw weapon.
Okay. All right, then. So now we have Worm Sign, right? So we've got the giant sandworms, and you can tell where the giant sandworms are because they've got their lightning strikes that shoot out of them. How come, A, the Fremen are now capable of riding things that create horizontal lightning out of themselves, and B, how come we don't have a desert full of glass now?
Because the worms eat glass?
No, John, worms eat the dirt, and the dirt makes the earth.
It's true.
That's the thing.
And people worms, hold hands.
Worms are just constantly churning the desert and eating whatever gets in the way. So they'd be eating the glass, and it turned back into sand as it gets broken down back into the basic silicon forms while going through the 1,000-year digestive tract of a giant worm. So that's for the glass. What about the lightning?
Well, so I can't remember what it's actually called when lightning hits glass, but it...
Fulgurites.
Fulgurites, yes. So
I did research
a lot. So when lightning hits sand, it creates a little cone of like natural glass. I don't know exactly how big it is. I thought it was
tubes, a couple mostly.
But it's a couple inches at least. And
depends on whether it's desert fulgurites or mountain fulgurites.
But basically, that's what happens when the lightning hits the ground. This lightning actually isn't hitting the ground. It's coming from the worm going into the atmosphere. So it doesn't actually need to make it. The worm is conducting everything.
Then how are we? How about those Fremen that are riding on the thing that's making this lightning?
Well, as soon as their electrons are balanced, they wouldn't be in trouble. They're just grounded by the worm. They got those weird riding spatulas, right? They get grounded?
No. It's a lot easier, John.
Oh.
See, everything in electricity needs to be grounded. So they just pick up a bunch of sand, put it in their pocket, and they become grounded.
That's not how grounding works, Eric.
I'm pretty sure. Well, then they wouldn't call it grounding if it didn't have to deal with ground. Listen, I have electrical friends. They know what they're talking about.
You have electrical friends?
Yeah. Guys who work with electricity.
I see.
I mean, we don't exactly know why the lightning happens, too, though. I'm just assuming that's actually just a side effect of all of the sand getting moved and the buildup in the air. So they wear rubber suits. They're uncomfortable, we know that. And they use weird shovel spatulas to ride the worm. Maybe that channels the lightning away from them, like a lightning rod?
Sure. Sounds good.
Listen, this is as much of a valid explanation as David Lynch's explanation.
He didn't give one.
Exactly.
We're a step ahead of David Lynch.
All right. So, speaking of the Fremen and their still suits, how come we're going to be running around in these things that are supposed to preserve our water, but they don't cover our heads and also they're black? Like, you know, that color you don't want to wear in the middle of a hot desert when the sun's out to keep, because it'll bake you.
Is the desert actually that hot, though?
Oh, yeah. I think at one point they listed that the ambient temperature was like 300 degrees. And I don't care what scale you're using. That's a lot.
Maybe. But there's also, they talk about like using decaliters or whatever of amounts of water. Maybe they're just using like, it's 300, like.
300 degrees Celsius is really hot.
Centicelsius. I don't know. 1/100th of a Celsius. I don't know. Metric. American, obviously. So when it's actually like 3 degrees Celsius.
They're black because they use nano solar panels.
But they said that the pumping action is powered by their walking.
That's a lie.
They lied to me in this movie?
Yes.
Among many things.
But how am I supposed to trust the rest of the film then?
You shouldn't have. That was the message. That's what you should have learned.
I thought that the message was that Paul Atreides could make it rain.
David Lynch couldn't make it let rain.
No, but Paul Atreides could.
Listen, the only people we can trust to make it rain is Toto.
All right, so now their heads aren't exposed, so we have to worry about them losing moisture through their mouth, their eyes, and the portion of their face that's exposed, and their head, which is going to collect sweat.
Isn't it explained that they need to breathe in through their mouth and out through their nose, right?
Well, yeah, but you're going to sweat, and the sweat's going to evaporate. And that's our issue here, is you're slowly losing water.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't they point out that there is a limit to how long the suit will keep you alive in the desert?
It's a couple weeks, but yes, there is a limit.
So you are slowly dehydrating, but it's efficient enough to keep that down. Because, I mean, what you're 5%, 10% of your skin is uncovered.
Yeah, but, like, your head loses a lot.
I think the suit's going to be cooling you down, too, so it kind of forces you to not sweat. Which is bad, but if the suit is cooling you down, you don't need to sweat.
Yeah, the stills are powered by your walking. All right, here we go. The stills are powered by your walking and movement, but the internal AC, that's powered by the solar panels.
Oh, the crystals.
The crystals. Resonance crystals.
All right.
Chalks off.
Sounds good to me.
It's new age crystal power.
And that is the list of plot holes.
And do we have any other plot holes?
Do we?
Like, all right, to be honest, to have enough, to be able to question the plot of this movie, you'd have to
understand the plot of the film.
You'd have to have a firm grasp on the plot.
The problem being that I have a firm grasp on the plot. They boil down the plot of the book to its barest essence. And while technically most of these events do happen in the book, and it will kind of make sense as it plays its way across, it doesn't do any of it justice. So we're not left with plot holes per se, we're just left with a very simplified plot that doesn't have plot holes per se. It's just dumb.
I'm just going to throw it out there. Tremors did it better. They should have gotten the people who made Tremors onto this movie.
All right, but the sandworms in this movie are iconic sandworms.
They are. They reminded me of the Tremors. Plus, the graboids. Graboids, that's what they're called.
Graboids didn't happen for another 6 years.
I think it's one of those... the idea was so good it permeated through time.
No, that's what the spice does.
Maybe if they spent less time having the mutant navigator spitting lasers out of his face, they could have spent more time on the plot.
Is that what that thing was at the beginning of the movie?
Yeah, that's like one of probably the first people who took spice to navigate through space. Because the more you use it, the more you change.
See, they didn't explain that in the movie.
They totally did. That's what that narrating space lady said at the beginning.
Oh, I maybe probably zoned out.
She was like, you take the spice and it allows you to live longer.
And full time and everything.
And full time, but it makes you mutate as well.
Well, now you're going to, now I'm kind of expecting me to watch this again, but I really don't want to.
I'm going
to
read the book. I haven't read the book, guys. I want to read the book because this movie made me angry.
The book itself is actually pretty good. I have read the book. I read it as a kid, and I didn't like it as a kid because I thought it was too depressing. But, I mean, that's what happens when you're in, like, sixth or seventh grade reading Dune. So, but then revisiting it later, I did enjoy it more. And I think I'm due for another reread rather than going and watching any versions of Dune.
When was the first time you saw the movie? Do you remember that?
The first time I saw it was 2005, 2006, because I was talking to somebody about Dune, and they were like, oh yeah, there's a movie, they made a couple of movies on it, and I didn't know, and then I went and I looked it up, and then I forgot about it again, because it was safer that way.
I remember watching the end. I don't remember any of the other bits, like none of that popped into my head, but I had seen the end, and what I remembered is of the little girl with blue eyes pulling these hoses out of this fat man with this weird suit and like his hideous face, and then he like flies in the air, and then he gets sucked into a sandworm mouth. And that's what I knew of Dune. And if the rest of the movie was that awesome,
well,
it'd be a better movie. And then What was your experience, Eric?
So this is my first time watching it, actually. And to do a mini Eeler or whatever, I really thought the spice worms were a more integral part of the story. Like, obviously they're integral, but I thought they were more like all-knowing gods sort of thing. Like, to get the spice, you have to go to the worms.
Like, I know the worm spice comes from the worms, but how exactly does it come from the worms? Is it like a mucus that they secrete?
I think it has to do with the plumes of vapor that they extrude out.
All right, so
I think that's what I gathered, but I'm not 100% sure.
It's not explained in the movie. It's just there is a connection. And Paul realizing that there's a connection is a major plot point, but then it never actually states what the connection is.
Yeah, and that's one of the things in, again, the book goes into a little bit better and a little bit deeper, is that one of the things that both the Emperor and the Navigators Guild have been keeping a secret is where exactly spice comes from. You get it from this planet, you mine it, and you know that it's usually around, like, the sandworms are near where you can find it. That's why it's dangerous to go there, but you also want it. But they make sure that nobody is... Yes, spice comes from sandworms.
Do they even mostly keep it a secret that the spice comes from Arrakis?
Not really. It's mostly just, why would you go there? It's the worst.
That is a pretty good sign to keep people from going place. Arrakis, why would you want to be here? It's the worst.
Instead, you could be living on your diesel planet full of green slime and...
and weird...
Easy open people.
Easy open people.
Or you could have, like, I don't know, your lake planet that's...
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest. Lake planet, best planet.
Trying to remember which
that's,
one.
That's that... where Paul comes from at first.
Oh, it was the...
It's the Atreides house planet.
Kaladin.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kaladin.
Which made me think of Brandon Sanderson, not gonna lie. So, maybe a connection there. Maybe this makes that, or maybe that connection makes this movie a slight bit better.
Like, I can see how Dune has influenced science fiction and fantasy from watching this movie and just knowing that there were these connections. And you're like, alright, that's a Dune thing. But this movie is just bad. I'm gonna say it, guys. This movie does not deserve cult classic rating.
Is it maybe people think it's so bad it's good?
The problem is this is not in the so bad it's good. It's not cheesy. There's no moment that brings you joy.
The real problem,
except maybe
the reason it gets cult classic status, is because it was made by David Lynch. And
so what was the deeper meaning there?
So people, you obviously, David Lynch made it to be fantastic and you just don't get it. And then you ask David Lynch and he's like, look, I don't like this movie. It didn't do well and it's not what I would have wanted. Ignore this movie, please. Oh, that's part of the secret meaning.
I heard if you watch this movie backwards, you actually get the full movie forwards.
That's a great, great rumor.
He said, explaining the deeper meaning to us all.
All right, so I'll be honest, not everything is horrible about this movie. I mean, having a fat guy fly through the air and get eaten by a sandworm, that left an impression on me, and I will always remember that scene.
But then you have the rest of the movie with that fat man.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. The first scene you saw him.
So it's in the diesel punk planet. He's in this weird garden place. There are people with, like, straws in their eyeballs and neck. And they're squirting out his pustules. And then he can fly later. And it's really goofy looking.
That first moment he flew.
Yeah, that was, I laughed. I'm like, is this really happening? And then it did. But not.
I went to Willy Wonka.
Yeah, the fizzy lifting drink was something in my mind. But when some of the weirder design choices and aesthetics do actually look pretty good and are very intriguing to me, and I wanted that for the whole movie instead of just for certain points, and then they go to the weird stuff. Like, the Emperor's Palace, that design is awesome. I'm going to give it that. Like, Eric's trying to think of where that was.
No, I remember the Emperor's Palace, but I don't.
Like the weird walls with all the like crenulations. That looks cool. That feels like space ostentatious, I'd say.
So my problem with the Emperor's Palace isn't really dealing with the actual location. It has to deal with, I think, the Navigators Guild or something. They're just saying that, hey, we need to kill this Mohaldim guy. But they're doing it to their own special group, and they're still carrying the translators as they talk to themselves in their own unique language, but it's translating for us. And I was just sitting there wondering, like, why do they need that? Why do they need to translate for themselves?
They need to translate for the audience instead of doing subtitles. Because if they were going to do subtitles, they maybe should have done that for everyone thinking their thoughts, which is just horrible. That's one of those things that destroys this movie, is we were arguing about how long this movie was, and it is feels a lot longer than it is because of how much exposition and narration and internal monologues are being externalized.
Basically, the biggest problem with this film, I'm going to kind of jump ahead a bit, but this film suffers from the tell, don't show philosophy. Dune is a, I'm assuming, a fairly dense book. I haven't read it.
It is.
But if I had been reading, you know, maybe 200 plus pages, I'm going to start internalizing more of just the intrinsic knowledge that I should know. Like, okay, this is the name of the spice. This is the name of the, this is the name of the emperor. But in this movie, they told me the name of the emperor once and then expected me to remember who he was 2 hours later. I mean, they always announced him as the emperor, but it's just, they told me a lot of stuff that I was supposed to know. And because that was an info dump, I glossed over.
Like, adapting this film, right, I think needs a bit more sci-fi knowledge of world building through visualization and picking out what people actually need to know. Like, explicitly, and also what they can infer. And that, this didn't do it.
Okay, so I'm going to bring up a specific scene. It's when Paul is going to be assassinated with that floating hypodermic needle. And he goes through in great detail saying, if I get stuck with this, or if it touches me, it's going to kill me. So do we really need him to tell us that? I think if he just looked scared or concerned, okay, that conveys to the audience, okay, this is dangerous. He also says that it's based off movement. Instead of telling us it's based off movement, maybe have a move, or maybe have something move in the room and the thing tracks it or whatever.
Yeah, like imagine like there's a house plant and it's moved by the vent and the leaves kind of flap a bit, and then this syringe, and you don't even need to tell people that a syringe is dangerous. Like, if there's a flying syringe, are you going to assume that's a good thing? Who here's going to assume that's a good thing?
Listen, I saw Phantasm. That was scary.
Yeah, that's not even a syringe. That's just a ball that, like, has sharp bits that stick out of it.
Screws, John. Eye-hole spaced screws.
Whereas, the syringe. This is a flying syringe. Like, you're afraid of syringes that aren't flying.
Especially when you get a syringe that is looking for you.
Yeah, and so then you wouldn't need the narration. It would be like, He sees the door, like the hole open. As soon as the hole open, I'm like, oh, something's about to happen. And then the syringe comes in. That's all slow. And then, like, it could have flown towards something that was slightly moving and, like, kind of stab into it and then pull free. And so now you know what the danger is as he's trying to get away.
I mean, maybe even have the, let's go with the houseplant example. Maybe the leaf starts to wilt or to burn or something. Like, it's going to show, okay, that this is the danger of this obstacle.
Or the whole thing with Yue as the traitor. You know he's the traitor before you even really meet him.
Because they announced it in their plot dump.
I missed that part too.
All right, so they say they have a traitor.
Okay,
and then the first time you see the traitor is Yue is when he's getting the secret message in the body in the palace. And then also, like, later on, they mention the traitor, and then the scene cuts to it's Yue coming out of a room.
And they zoom in on his face. He doesn't say anything. He just looks at the camera.
Like, so there's no, like, the fact that there's, like, a traitor is never really a source of tension. It's kind of like where we have our Fremen woman who is saved by the prince from the syringe, and she promises to serve him and with her life, and then she is dead in the next scene we have with her, having done nothing. She just dies.
Yeah.
I feel like if I was doing the movie, I would have started on Arrakis already. And I would totally skip out on the fact that the emperor is part of the plot and skip over the flight, the jump to Arrakis, the information of the whole plot. You'd come in with the same knowledge that Paul Atreides had, and you might reference the fact that this new planet is entirely different from their home planet. He's like, I miss Caladan. Like,
I don't like
Kaladin
sand.
Kaladin had the waves, and they're beautiful, but I'm starting to enjoy the sand.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough.
And then, like, you can show the worms attacking and following someone through a sensing, and then someone will drop down, like, one of the thumpers. You don't have to even name that it's a thumper or really explain too much about it. What it does is because it does make sound rhythmically, and you're like, all right, the worms can track by sound.
I think they could even follow how the original movie has the shuttle going to warn the mining platform or collection platform, whatever it's called.
Yeah, you could jump right in. And to be honest, if I were making the movie, I would probably stop with Radaban as the villain. Raban. I threw in an extra dab because he's a monster now for Monster Hunter.
Yep.
Raban as the villain of this movie. Because I'd assume we'd want to do a full... I probably would do the thing where I'm like, I'm expecting a sequel. I'm going to be cocky there, but I'd be a lot more subtle with it. Because you'd start to introduce the fact that this whole plot is from the Emperor and the Navigators Guild specifically pulling strings.
And you could end when they, you know, when the Emperor shows up and offs Raban at the end.
Yeah. Raban escapes and it's the Emperor who kills him, but the Fremen have been attacking an uprising, and that's how they do it. So that's how I would have done the movie. You wouldn't be able to adapt the whole book, but that's an adaptable story from the book that still leaves openings for more book. You don't cut out any of the portions of the story leading up to that. And we know that Paul Atreides is probably part witch and has the weirding words, and establish that, find out about sandworms and the interaction with the Fremen. And then you'd still have your action, your intrigue, and it'd be a movie that is accessible to everyone, but there'd be more for the people who knew the material. Unlike Dune, which is missing stuff for the people who know and is too dense and confusing for the people who don't. It is a movie for no one. That is my official opinion on Dune.
And my thing is with having UA as the traitor, and you really don't need to say it, because having that would make watching it more interesting, because you have this whole like inner circle for Paul Atreides and his father, because you get Captain Picard's character and the Mentat with the giant eyebrows and the doctor, and then you're trying to figure out which one of them is the traitor. And it becomes a source of tension and a source of intrigue that you can watch to try to figure out. Especially, like, you know, you have the captain that disappears because he thinks everybody's dead. But, you know, maybe Paul's still trying to figure out whether or not he's the traitor, because he never gets to find out.
I mean, I guess that's a good point. I didn't think about that, is that Paul doesn't actually know that it was Yue.
He never knows.
In fact, because Yue left signs to help them, like clues of how to escape in that situation, escape from the shuttle, that he was probably not the traitor. Of course, that's until Paul gains superhuman abilities, and then he knows everything.
Yeah, well, once you take the spice so that your eyes turn blue and you get to see through time and knife fight Sting...
Yeah, but he's also the super eugenics boy who was bred into existence by the witches.
Yes.
I like Eric sitting there like, I watched this movie. I don't remember any of that.
No, I got the eugenics, the witches part. I didn't know Sting was genetically made for this. I thought he was just kind of like the grandson of the Baron or the cousin. I can't remember. Or I don't know. The only part that I had a problem with Sting is when they're knife fighting at the end and Sting gets the extra blade.
The side blade.
And then,
all right, that was actually ridiculous bad. That was the funny bit.
Well, here's the thing though. Paul ends up landing on it, like when he goes to do a takedown maneuver.
And but remember, he whispered really quietly into the mic in his thoughts about how he was going to avoid it by like folding like the wind or something.
Yeah, folding like a reed specifically, and then lands right on it.
No, see, he didn't land right on it. He left a little space. He left the Holy Spirit between them. There was a Bible distance between him and Sting.
John, don't
as he
you
knocked
know
him over.
John, the Bible comes on CD now. That doesn't work.
But yeah, I'll be honest, yeah, that was a moment that was hilariously bad. The side knife comes out and I'm like, snort, that's put all that effort into a weapon that is
pointless? No, well, not
that has a very specific use that's rarely ever going to happen. You should have just put a gun.
A chest
gun. Or a poison dart. Or like one of those syringes pops up and goes, nyeh. This is better use of your spacesuit hiding technology than one random blade.
What can you do, guys?
Bend like a reed, I guess.
All right, so now it comes to the question. Desert Island. Where does this go?
We don't have to put this one in our Desert Island rotation. It wasn't part of our, like, summer blockbusters that lost money.
It is a big movie that lost money, though. You can just say no. It's not. It doesn't win.
Well, it doesn't win, John.
It's not going to beat out Scott Pilgrim. I'm sorry.
It is not going to beat out Scott Pilgrim. And I'm going to say, if I was stuck on a desert island with Dune, I would escape from that island, and Dune would help me. So that's Dune's redeeming quality, is it would motivate me to get to the mainland.
You're going to take that VCR or that video cassette, tear out the tape, obviously, because you don't have a VCR to play it, fashion an oar out of it, or maybe even...
He can use the like tape as binding material for his raft.
It would be on Laserdisc, so I could use the Laserdisc to start fires and signal airplanes.
Did it come out on Laserdisc? When did Laserdisc come
Probably.
Out?
Laserdisc came out late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
This was 81?
84.
84. You might be able to get Betamax out of this.
I feel like this is a movie that was put on Laserdisc specifically. I don't think there are very many, but I could see Dune being on Laserdisc.
Well, time to check something really quick.
Well, while you're checking that out, we can talk about Fulgurites, because Fulgurites are really cool, actually.
Maybe you should just talk about Fulgurites.
I should, but that's a different thing.
Dune did come out on Laserdisc.
Yeah, I called it.
You can buy it. Let's see. It's a two-disc version for $16.53 on eBay.
A steal.
Is it, though?
Well, it would be if I didn't pay them.
All right, but what do you guys think about Dune? Have you watched it? Are you planning on not watching it now that we've talked about it? What about the 2021 version that's coming out soon?
Assuming anything hits the theaters ever again.
You can tell us on Facebook, maybe. Give us a like, because you enjoyed us talking about how David Lynch's movie was not good. Because we agree with David Lynch.
Give us a hate tweet on Twitter about how we're wrong and don't understand things, because David Lynch obviously was wrong when he said that he didn't make it on purpose, and that's just part of the plot. Just at us at PlotSpacklePod.
Or... if you really want to get into how Dune inspired Twin Peaks and how they're both interconnected, send us an email to plotspacklepodcast@gmail.com. No theory is too crazy, except when it is.
And of course, the people that we would, you know, have to fight a revolt to get off of Dune with are Patreon members.
Which we're going to thank. Because they're better than Spice. They're better than Melange.
Well, that's true.
Because they keep us going. They make this possible.
They don't make our eyes turn blue.
And they're not an addictive substance that comes out of a giant worm. Theoretically, if you are an addictive substance that comes out of a giant worm and are paying us money, I'm sorry I have offended you.
Isn't that a tequila brand, John? What's a tequila that has the worm in it?
Isn't it all tequila has the worm in it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's very specific to tequila.
You know, ending on tequila is the most Dune thing ever. No, though, really, though, this new movie, I'm just cynic at it. I don't think it's going to be very good because I feel like it is being reminiscent of the 1984 version, which means it's aiming for a very small audience.
But it has Oscar Isaac in it. He was in Ex Machina, and that was a great movie.
He was also in New Star Wars.
Oh.
Way to make people sad.
I didn't want to remember that. Like, to be fair, Oscar Isaac is probably one of the better parts of New Star Wars.
See, I would accept all of these as good reasons either for your new Dune or against your new Dune. Remember that the Dune 1984 actually had a fabulous cast.
It did.
And we still got this.
So I just feel like they keep trying to make Dune the new Star Wars, and
it's not going to happen.
And Star Wars isn't even the new Star Wars.